Session number 22323, Rule 6.
In hospital, to what degree were you sort of eager to get out, to go back to your comrades?
Well, we were all very eager. Some of the men badly wounded, they went out on regular intervals back to Australia, shipped out on from the hospital back to Australia while I was there. I think about three different lots went out, and I think they gathered up down on the canal and eventually went out on hospital ships. And that they were going out all the time. They were disabled. The very, very sick ones, of course, they didn't move, but the other ones had lost an arm or leg. That chap who'd been with me when we crossed the border and had lost his leg, he went back to Australia. No, quite a few of them went back to Australia, but the others, like myself, we wanted to get back to the unit, and we'd heard, well, the hospital was no good, that's what I'm holding it. It was, nobody likes being in the hospital. I don't care whether it's a civil hospital or army hospital, whether there's a war on or not, that we were keen to get back to the unit.
Well, I wanted to discuss that because you've been wounded, and one would think that the last thing you want to do is to actually get in amongst it again.
I don't know. That's one of the chaps who were with me who'd been shot during crossing up above higher up the river. He had been shot through the face, and he's very lucky. He turned around to shout to somebody behind him crossing the river, and a bullet went through his mouth, into one cheek and out the other cheek. He was shot in the shoulder, only a slight wound, and he shot in the leg. And he recovered. He was dead keen to get back. We're all dead keen to get back, because you wanted to be with your unit. Sort of same when we going across in India, we didn't want to be left behind. Wanted to be with our unit all the time, and it was the same. I stayed with my unit till the end of the war, and they wanted to ship me out, give me a commission. I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay with the unit. They were mates, and that was it. And I can't describe it any other way that we were dead keen to get back to our unit. And some of them went to AWL from hospital trying to make it back. They didn't get far, of course. They got caught and brought back. But that's how it was. We wanted to get back to the unit. And when I eventually got back to the unit, I'd missed Beirut. We were up at a place called Tyre. I can't even name it. It's up in the foothills, out from Tripoli. And we were in a village, taking over this village, and still the Arabs were still there. And we'd taken over this village, and we only spent about three or four days there. This is when I caught up to the rest of the battalion. I should mention, I suppose, that I'd been put on a ship or a boat in Haifa and taken up to Tripoli by boat. And I called in at Beirut and saw a bit of Beirut.
Tell us what it was like.
Beirut was a beautiful city. Known over there as a little Paris, because the French had built it up into a beautiful little city. And I was very much struck with it. Beautiful white buildings, gardens, a very lovely little place. Anyhow, we went up into this...
How were you seen as the victorious soldiers coming into Beirut by the locals?
There's nothing. They took over. The army took over everything in Beirut. And from there, they shipped thousands of the Vichy French back to France. They were, they, uh, they didn't keep any prisoners over there. They shipped them back to France. And some of them wanted to go. They had to leave their women folk behind. If they, I don't know, all actual wife and anything else. But they, with our job, or my battalion's job, I wasn't there, was to see that these soldiers got on the ships and went off to, went back to France. I presume they shipped in the far of the Mediterranean, where they went to Marseillaise or somewhere like that. But they were shipped back there, and they left everything behind except what they could carry, practically. They had their homes and other belongings in Beirut. But our battalion just took over the whole area there, and the other battalions did too. They were further out, I understand. But the population welcomed Australians.
Did you have any concerns for what was going on elsewhere in the Mediterranean, or regard the wider war?
At that stage, we'd heard that we're doing very well in the desert. That Rommel hadn't started his show there. Well, I shouldn't say we're doing very well, but we're holding things in the desert. Tobruk was holding out, and everything south of Tobruk was holding. And these chaps came back from Tobruk. We saw them. We spoke to them. We camped with them in the convalescent camp. And some of them in a very, very bad way with shell shock and things like that. They didn't keep them in hospital. They just put them in this con camp. They live there in the tents and things. But we didn't worry about that. We worried about our own little show all the time. We didn't. Outside, some of the officers might have worried, but we certainly didn't. And when we got up to, out from Tripoli, we went up to this really delightful little place in the hills, built on the side of the hills. And from there we spent, I think, about 3 days there, and then we were sent up onto the border, the Turkish border. And we were in tents up there. We were supplied by mules, running by the mules that had Cypriots in charge of them. And they used to bring our supplies up. And it was rather a joke because we had no idea what was going on. All we knew, we were up there in case the Turks or the Germans came down over the border. We didn't know who it was that had come down. And we spent a lot of our time, the hills are covered in little white stones. All Syria, Lebanon, seemed to be covered in little white stones, the hills. And we made these lines up to the border. Little white stones, we could find our way up in the night time if we had to, on patrols and things like that. But we camped in tents on the side of a hill by an old glacier. And from that glacier, as it melted, we'd get our drinking supply, our water for our cooking and our drinking. And we camped there. We weren't there very long. We'd finished putting these little stones down all the way up to the border. And then that night it snowed. And by Jove, it did snow. It really snowed. And the tents collapsed. Everything collapsed. And that's where I learned how to hate snow. I hated it. Might be all right in a nice place up in the hills where you've got warm rooms and everything else, but to be in a tent when the snows is no fun at all. And after the snow, the sleet came, and then it got that bad we had to move back to this little town. And I'm just going crook. I know the name of that town so well, and I just can't think of it. Siridani was the name of the town. And we moved back there. At that stage, the Cypriots had been kicked out, and we got the Indians. I forget whether they weren't Gurkhas. They were, I can't remember which Indian, what tribe they were. But they were good. They looked after their mules and cared for them in a big way. Their mules became their children. And if we tried to hang anything on the mules, lighten our burden when we were moving, they'd just pick it up and throw it on the ground. They wouldn't take anything like that. They looked after their mules very well. And we moved back to Sudani, and we didn't do anything much there. When I say we didn't do any much, we, on the outskirts, we dug in and prepared fortifications, defensive lines, in case anybody came down from the border. And we stayed there. We were there for Christmas, with our second Christmas over there. And we mingled very well with the Arabs. I suppose they're called Arabs or Syrians, whatever you like to call them. We knew them as Arabs. And at one stage, my platoon was moved out onto to guard a tunnel that ran along about 12 miles south of Tripoli. This tunnel was right on the edge of the sea, and it was through a very, very steep line of hills. And we had to guard that tunnel to stop it from, in case anyone would blow it up. They'd have trouble blowing it up. It was terrific.
Did you feel as though you were really in a war at this stage?
We didn't know what was going on. We didn't have a clue. At this stage, we thought the troops were, the enemy might come across from Crete and Cyprus and attack us there. We thought they might attack us from the north. But I can't say we worried very much about it. We knew they were, if anything, better trained than us and had better arms and everything else, but that never seemed to worry us very much. We were just there, and if they came, they came, sort of business, and that was it.
You mentioned that you were there for Christmas. What was Christmas like in 1941?
Yeah, well, we were at Sudani in Christmas 41. We'd always been well supplied with the canteen goods. Of course, we didn't have very much money to spend, but the Australian Comfort Fund had been very good to us. They'd sent us over things for Christmas. We got their Christmas parcels. But we depended a tremendous lot on our relatives and our friends back in Australia for Christmas, for parcels, all the time we were over there. We got cake from home. We got they took a long time to come, of course, and we got socks and parcels, razor blades. Razor blades were terribly scarce over there. All through the time we were over in the Middle East, razor blades were very hard to get, but we'd get them from home. And Christmas over there, we had quite a little party in our own company, and our own platoon. In the up in the Sudani, the Syrians or the Arabs, they put on their own shows there at that time.
What sort of shows?
The dancing and the Ramadan. They had that when they don't eat from a certain time, and then when it finishes, I think it's a fortnight later or a month later, they really have a go. But they used to come and dance their music, and we'd cheer them on, and we'd never join in, but we never heard them by joining in, but we'd watch them, and we'd there were no actually restaurants, as you call a restaurant, a place where you could eat in Sudani. Actually, I know one. And
tell us about it.
Outside the town a little bit, two of my mates and I went down there, and we ordered this meal. It was a a grill, and I remember a bit of steak and a bit of liver, and we thought it was very, very nice food, and we congratulated the restaurant. And we were the only ones in there, we were the only ones that had any money to spend, it seemed. And we congratulate the chappie running a show, and we sat around a while, smoking a while, and then we made our way back to through the town. Now, there were two streets in the town. One went, came down past the barber shop, and we used to have a haircut and a few other little shops there. And then there's another street at the back of that, curved round. And this time we decided we'd go up this curved street, the street up to the hill where we camped. And we had gone halfway up there. We saw them slaughtering a bullock, deer, cat or cow, whatever you like to call it. I don't know what it was. It was some sort of beast, a steer, I should say. And there was our restaurant owner, chappie, with a basket, raking up all these entrails and setting any higgly piggly off the ground into his basket, and put a cloth off and off back to the restaurant. And that's the, we didn't feel so good then about what we'd eaten in the restaurant, because we saw what how roughly they'd butchered this beast and gathered up the entrails and things like that that we'd probably been eating. Anyhow, that was just one little thing.
I wanted to ask you what some of the news from home was at that time, round about Christmas.
All censored, never heard of a thing. All during the war, every letter we had was censored. Actually, my sister wrote over to me and said, their letters weren't censored, I don't think. I can't remember. No, their letters weren't censored. But they were not to put anything in from home. But we were very heavily censored. She wrote back and said, "Do you know that so-and-so lieutenant is censoring your letters?" I knew, of course. But the idea was you wrote a letter, and the censor had a razor blade, and he just cut whole strips out of what he thought was shouldn't be going to the letter. And then the strips went home. Some were heavily censored. In my case, I don't think anything was censored. I'd never put anything in that had to be censored. Afterwards, when I became an officer and I did the censoring, I found it the same. You never really read the letter that you were censoring. You just scanned it. And you picked up, if you saw a name like Libya or something like that, it meant something, or a German, something like that meant something. But otherwise, you just scanned the whole letter and it never registered in your mind anything about it, because you're doing so many of them. One officer was doing a whole platoon, and you just it was no trouble censoring letters. We had no knowledge of what was going on and what was going on elsewhere. What little we did, we couldn't put in our letters. And, of course, the chaps coming back wounded, they used to give graphic accounts to the people back home, but we were never allowed to tell anything, and we never knew what was going on.
Did you have any understanding of the Japanese at this point?
The Japanese hadn't come in at that stage, I don't think. They came in soon afterwards, and that was when we moved south back into Palestine. And that's when we realised about the Japanese coming.
Had you heard about Pearl Harbor, for instance?
No, never knew a thing about Pearl Harbor. Never knew anything about it. Singapore was the only thing we knew about. We'd heard about the fall of Singapore. And that was all we'd heard. We never knew anything else.
At what stage then did you realise you were going to be coming back to Australia?
Oh, well, when we moved out, the 9th Divi were kept, the 7th Divi came home. The 7th Divi moved from Tobruk, the Africans took over in Tobruk and lost it soon afterwards, South Africans. Their heart wasn't in it. And And the 9th Divi came back and regrouped in Palestine. They took over from us, one of their battalions took over from us at Sirdani. We moved back into Hill 59 in Palestine. And there we knew we were going to come home. Or we didn't know we were coming home. We knew we were moving back into the Indian Ocean.
Had you heard?
At that stage we didn't know. We moved back into the Indian Ocean. And it wasn't until we got down and onto the canal and eventually boarded the Ile de France, this whopping big, beautiful big ship that had been captured from the French, or taken from the French in Singapore. And we realised that really there was something on.
Had you heard about Curtin and his attitudes towards...
No, never heard a word. Never heard a word. All we heard was that we were on this Dominion Monarch, and that took us as far as Bombay, and we anchored out in Bombay for a while. I was given command of the 6-inch gun on the stern, the only gun on the ship.
What did that involve?
Picking a few of my men, there were four British gunners, or men on the gun, and I had to pick, I think, 7 or 8 men out of my platoon. At the stage I was sergeant of the platoon, I'd been promoted to sergeant, and I had to pick 7 or 8 men that I knew who would be capable of doing their job on the gun, and I picked the gun and them on the gun, and we looked after that gun till we got to Bombay. And when we got to Bombay, the morning we got to Bombay, we were sleeping up, had our hammocks strung underneath the gun on the stern, and I was awakened by one of my chaps, one of my men, and he said, "So-and-so, Bob, gone off." I said, "Don't be silly, he couldn't get off. How would he get off? We were way out in the harbour." And he said, "Oh, no, he's dead." And evidently this chap had died. He was a butcher by trade, and he'd been down in the, when he got on Dominion's Monarch, they called for people to go down and do various jobs. He'd gone down into the butchering business, got frozen down there, come up, and on the hot night in the Bombay, he died, a heart of failure. So then I was given the task of taking a guard of honour ashore and seeing that he's buried. And so I had 6 men and myself, and we went ashore, and of course it was all British. There were no Australian troops, to my knowledge, in Bombay at that time, except one captain who'd come down from Delhi. He'd somehow been left behind and gone up to Delhi. And then he was in these British barracks. All the British, where we were, the barracks where we were empty, except for this one captain. And there we waited for a day, and I had to draw some blank ammunition, which was a terrific job. I think I had to find out five sheets of papers to get these 12 rounds of ammunition, blank ammunition. The British were so careful about it. And eventually I drew the blank ammunition. And next morning we went into 2 trucks and went out to the cemetery, followed the hearse on a gun carriage out to the cemetery, not on a gun carriage, on a 4x4, out to the cemetery. And going out there, we travelled at a terrific pace. What I thought was another 12 mile an hour funeral pace. We did about 20, 25 mile an hour. And I said to the driver, I said, "Oh, Lord, you'll kill somebody." And he said, "That's all right." He said, "As long as I kill them." He said, "Trouble is, if you hurt them, you get into trouble, you're sued. If you kill them, it's okay." And that was his attitude. If you if you injured one, well, the other, the family asked compensation from the British. If you killed him, I think it was a small fixed price that you had to, they had to pay. Anyhow, we got out the cemetery and buried our soldier and fired the 12 rounds cleaned the rifle, I examined the rifles, saw they were empty, and started back down to the gates to get to our vehicle. And we heard all this shouting going on behind us, and we took no notice of it. There was a lot of shouting. But when we got to the gates, there was a crowd there stopping us, and they'd heard the shouts behind us. And we had to wait there for about a quarter an hour, because in that time, the empty rounds, the cartridge cases that we hadn't worried about, had fallen into the soil on the edge of the grave and trodden in there. And we had to wait then till these 12 rounds, cartridge cases, had been collected and brought down to us. We had no idea. We in the army, we didn't worry about the cartridge cases. You just fired this thing and that was it. But they eventually let us go when they counted the cartridge cases to us, 12 of them, 12 shots. And so I had these. I put them in my pocket. That's all I had. My tunic, not my tunic, in my trouser pocket because I was in short and shirt. And we went back to barracks. When I got back to barracks, I tied everything to get rid of these 12 cartridge cases. I dumped them out the window. I dumped them everywhere. But each time I dumped them, they were brought back to me by the Indians. And I was told then that that there was death or heavy imprisonment for any Indian caught with a cartridge case, because the British Army knew that cartridge case could be reloaded and used against them, and therefore they put this punishment on any Indian who was caught with this cartridge case. Anyhow, I forget what I did with them. I left in the hut, in the haversack in the hut, and I was lucky because I had money in my pay book. We had no money at all. We'd been changed from the Syrian money into Palestinian money, and from Palestinian money into Egyptian money, and that was then no good. And we had no money at all, but I had money in my pay book, and this captain lent me his tunic. I dressed myself out as a captain. I went up to the pay office and drew money from the pay office on my pay book. You could empty do that because the Australian Army pay book was good. And that money came. And I shared it out among the chaps, the six men with me. We had a wonderful time. We were in Bombay for 3 days. We were the only Australian troops that I know of in Bombay. We went out to Higgins' stable again, had a look at his horses. We went up to the bath up on the other side of Bombay, on the north side of Bombay, and we had a wonderful time. We still couldn't go into I could go into a hotel because I had a sergeant's stripes, but I went with the troops because we couldn't go into any decent hotel or anything like that because of the it was officers and sergeants only.
So you did quite a bit of sightseeing while you were there.
No, well, we saw sightseeing as far as it goes. We saw how the poor lived, because when we drove out to the cemetery, we saw the poor there, and we'd see them at night time sleeping on the pavements, lying by the thousands on the pavements, and they'd come around with a child, no arms and no legs, and the child could turn himself into knots because he'd been trained to do that for soliciting, begging, and seeing like, and seeing things like that, which in how poor they lived. And but going up to these two baths, the in sea water bath and the other bath, swimming bath up in the, I can't even name it now, name of the hill. As you went up there, on the left, you passed these beautiful hockey fields. On your right, you passed the cemetery, which wasn't a cemetery. All it was with all the ravens eating the bodies on top of they put the bodies up on stilts, on poles, for the birds to be fed off. And you could watch them as you went past. But a bit further, there's beautiful homes where the upper class Indians lived. And they were lovely homes. And they abutted onto the hockey fields and those playing fields behind. And there was an election on the Saturday we were there. We saw the elections being carried out, which was a terrific thing. How they do it, I don't know. There's thousands and thousands of them voting. Anyhow, we had a good time.